to order. Sorry, others are running a little late.
Mic back here. We are reversing the order of the agenda right now. The author of that, the bill, Senator Hahn, is tied up in another place, and so we'll begin with the governor's education finance bill. So I would invite whoever is going to present, along with Senator Stumpf, the author. The bill was put in for introduction, so it will be introduced tomorrow. But it was available, so it's available for you, and we've asked the staff to come and present it. Welcome, Commissioner, and Dr. Melcher, as well as Senator Stumpf. Senator Stumpf, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. Now we're going to get into some more of what I think all of you, why all of you got onto the committee, so that you can have data runs and spreadsheets and all the fine numbers. Now we are very appreciative that we can have the Commissioner and Mr. Melcher go through the governor's proposal for you. And you do have a number of pieces of paper in front of you, which include a number of different items that Mr. Melcher and the Commissioner will cover. It gives a good layout, I think, of the finance part of the governor's budget. And we can kind of fill in the program areas as we go through. So I think maybe to start out, maybe we have Commissioner Castellas to start out, and then Mr. Melcher, Dr. Melcher, go through some of the runs.
Madam Chair.
Commissioner Castellas.
Madam Chair, I want to thank you for hearing the governor's bill today, and Senator Stumpf and Representative Greiling will be carrying it in the House. Very appreciative of that and your collaboration. Also really want to thank our MDE staff for putting together the bill. They worked very hard, diligently, and collaborating with the team at MMB as well. And they're all here to answer any questions if you have other questions. I'm going to turn it over to Tom Melcher. I've talked about the seven-point plan with the senators here and in the committee, as well as when we first introduced our priorities and before having a formalized bill. Came and spoke before this committee as well on the policy aspects of this bill, and I know that you're very interested in the specifics, so I'll introduce Tom Melcher, who has worked diligently on this for you, and we're very excited to be able to present this this today. Tom.
Dr. Melcher.
Thank you. Madam Chair and members, my name is Tom Melcher with the Department of Education, and I'll be walking through some of the numbers in the bill and then the language that goes with them. I'd like to start with there's a landscape one-page spreadsheet that summarizes the governor's recommendations, and I'll start with that, and then I have some backup information that shows impacts on various school districts and so forth. The one-page spreadsheet is broken into three sections, and the top section deals with the payment shift and the governor's recommendation related to that. The governor is recommending that we continue the 70-30 payment schedule to school districts for two more years, fiscal year 12 and fiscal year 13, and then beginning in fiscal year 14, that there be a fixed schedule where we're each year increasing the state aid payment percentage by 2%, so that over a 10-year period, we would be back to a 90-10 funding basis. In the event that the state economy improves more quickly, that existing language in state law would take effect and would override this. So on the spreadsheet, if you look toward the right-hand side, you'll see some numbers that are in a heavy outline that show the biennial appropriation impacts. And on this particular section of the bill, the bottom line is that there is a saving to the state budget of $1,440,000,000 during the current biennium from maintaining the 70-30 payment schedule. And then there's a cost of $240 million in the 14-15 biennium that's associated with the first 2 years of that buyback going to 72% in fiscal year 14 and to 74% in fiscal year 15. If you're also following in the bill, you could turn to page 21, lines 17 through 21 are the language in the bill that delays that payment percentage to payback and then creates the 10-year phase-in period where we'd be going from 72 to 74 and so forth over a period of years. The next section on the spreadsheet shows the various places where the governor is recommending reductions in the K-12 area. And again, looking at that same block over toward the right-hand side of the spreadsheet, you'll see the governor's recommending about $28 million in reductions in the K-12 budget during the current biennium and about $27 million reductions in the tails that are then offset by increases in the bottom section. But I'll talk about the reductions first. The first change is a reduction in the Department of Education budget of 5%, and that amounts to $991,000 per year. I believe this is consistent with recommendations that the governor has made in other state agencies that are kind of comparable magnitude. The next line is a change in the tax shift methodology, and that appears on lines on page 20 of the bill, actually. The language is on page 20, line 6 of the bill. And what this would do, it would have the Department of Education calculate the property tax shift using the gross school district levy before property tax credits rather than the net levy after credits. There's a savings of $13.7 million, as you'll see on your spreadsheet in the current biennium from doing that. This also will make the property tax shift calculations, which are very complex, a lot simpler. Currently, we need to wait until December to get final data on the property tax credits in order to provide information to the school districts on their actual property tax shift amount. That delays the school districts in closing their books at the end of the fiscal year. If we take the credits out of the calculation, we can do the calculations of the tax shift in June, and that allows school districts to close their books accurately much earlier. So this will be a little bit of a savings administratively to the districts in terms of not having to make a guess as to what that tax shift number will come in at, and also make some benefit to the state budget for this one-time basis. The next recommendation the governor has is to eliminate magnet school grants. In the bill, this is on page 16 in the repealers, line 16.14. The governor is recommending eliminating that, which is a cost, which is a savings of $750,000 per year. The next recommendation of the governor is to eliminate state funding for the Explore and plan tests. The language for that is on page 7 of the bill. The governor is not repealing the entire statute here, but simply eliminating the provision that calls for the Commissioner of Education to reimburse school districts. So school districts could still offer the plan and explore test to students if they choose to do so. This would eliminate the state aid to districts if they do that. Next, we have the adult basic education program. This is one of the very few areas where the state has provided an automatic inflationary factor in the formula. We've been inflating this at 3% a year, and the governor is recommending that this be inflated at 2% a year instead of 3%. 2% is closer to the growth in consumer price index, and currently I think adult basic education programs are in pretty good shape. There has been quite a bit of growth over the last several years. This 3% factor has been in place for a number of years. We think there may be some minimal wait lists created in the metro area by doing this, but we think that they would be manageable. The next change is the QCOM program, and the governor is recommending that no new QCOM districts be approved after February 1st, 2011. That language change is on page 8 and 9 of the bill. So school districts that have not been approved for QCOM by February 1st, 2011 would not be allowed to go into the program.
Implemented by October 1st.
If the school district has been approved but has not yet voted on the plan, they would have until October 1st to have a vote done. So in the case of Anoka, for example, they're approved. They voted it down. They'd have time for another vote if they chose to do that before October 1st. We also have, I think, about a half dozen other school districts that have been approved that have not yet voted. So it gives them some time to get that done, but they would have to implement for the next school year by the October 1 date in order to receive funding for the program.
Dr. Melcher or Commissioner, could you provide the names of those districts, of those ones that have been approved but haven't yet voted?
Yes, we can do that.
Thank you.
We can provide that to you, yes. Okay. The next line here is that there's a tax shift cost because of the freeze on growth in QCOMP. The state has been booking savings each year based on 48% of property tax increases in the tax shift. So we would have a little bit less in the way of tax shift savings, and that's carried as a cost. The next item is the charter school building lease grandfather. The governor is recommending that the grandfather be eliminated. That grandfather language is on page 10 of the bill. I also have a computer run that was distributed. It's a landscape computer run of 3 or 4 pages. Excuse me. And what that run shows is all of the charter schools in the state, and rank orders the charter schools based on their lease cost per pupil, and shows which of them currently receive a grandfather, which ones do not, and so how they would be affected. There are 19 charter schools that would be affected by the elimination of the grandfather. Those are listed here. One of the things you will see here is that there are many other charter schools who have costs that are very similar to charter schools that are grandfathered, and it's just a matter of what funding level they had in 2003 as to whether they're getting $1,500 per pupil or $1,200 per pupil. So this would put everybody on a level playing field. All the schools would be getting a $1,200 per pupil limit. It would be a reduction of $1.7 million for the biennium in state aid. The next recommendation is coming actually from the academies. It's not from the Department of Education as such, but rather from the Faribault Academies. This would allow for trial placement at the academies. It would provide for more parental choice in the placement of students at the academies. The language here is on page 27 of the bill. There's also been some legislation introduced here, so you may have heard this bill at another time.
Dr. Melcher, you skipped over the eliminating the charter school startup. Do you want to just review that a bit?
Thank you, Madam Chair. The governor is also recommending eliminating charter school startup. That would be a savings to the state of $1,549,000. The way that the language in the bill is drafted for the charter school startup, that's on page 12, lines 8 through 11. The charter schools that started in 2011 would receive their funding for the second year. It's a two-year program. This would apply to new charter schools that would be starting in 2012 and later. Part of the rationale, I believe, for doing this is that the charter schools do continue to qualify for federal startup aid, so that we're eliminating the state startup aid but not the federal startup aid, and we would we would honor the commitment that was made to the schools that started in 11 to pay them their second year. But this would kick in for new schools.
Dr. Melcher, the state startup is it $50,000, and is that spread over 2 years, or is it $50,000 each for 2 years?
It's each year for 2 years, Madam Chair.
So $50,000 each for 2 years. And the federal, can you just contrast that, what the federal aid is?
The federal startup, I wish I had more detail. I think that's a three-year program. The federal startup tends to start for planning as well as operations, so they can get the federal money before the state, they actually start operations. And I don't have the exact numbers with me. I can certainly get those for you. But the federal startup aid is a larger sum of money than the state startup aid.
Thank you.
Yeah. Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid.
May I just ask, Mr. Melcher, can schools get both of those now, or is it just one or the other?
Madam Chair and Senator Scheid, charter schools now get both of them.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
So that is the reductions that are being proposed by the governor. They amount to $27,958,000 during the biennium. At the very bottom of the page, you will see the reinvestments that the governor is recommending. Those amount to $51 million in the current biennium and $123 million in the tails. And the first of these is an optional all-day kindergarten program that would provide funding for students that are eligible for free or reduced price lunches. I do have a computer run in your packet which shows the impact of that on a school district by school district basis. This money would only be available to school districts or charter schools that provide a free all-day, everyday K program to all of the students enrolled in a particular building. So a school district that has multiple elementaries could choose to implement this in one school or all of their elementary schools. But in order to qualify, they would have to be providing a free all-day, everyday K program for the students in that particular school. The language for this is on page 2 and page 3 of the bill. What this is doing is adding a weighting of 0.388 for those students who are eligible for free or reduced price lunch who are enrolled in an all-day, everyday K program. We currently weight kindergarten students at a 0.612 weighting, so by adding the 0.388, we get up to a full 1.0 weight for kindergarten students, and so they would be generating $5,124 in total for the program if they qualify for free or reduced price lunches. The computer run shows the number of kindergarten students at each school district. The very top of the first page shows a breakdown for Minneapolis and St. Paul as opposed to the suburbs, as opposed to small, medium, and large rural schools. We also show the number of students at each school district in elementaries that are eligible for free or reduced price lunch. So you can see on a district-by-district basis the percentage of students that would be funded. So that does vary quite a bit among school districts based on the poverty level. There's actually going to be two impacts to this. The primary impact is the additional $1,988 that would be provided for students that were eligible for free or reduced price lunch that would be enrolled in these programs. And that is shown in column G of the report. There's also an effect on handicapped kindergarten enrollment. Currently, there's no limit. Handicapped students can be enrolled full-time in kindergarten, but quite often they're only enrolled part-time if their cohort that they're with is only enrolled part-time. So we think there would be an impact where some of the disabled students that are kindergartners would be served more hours. And so we've also shown the impact of that, and that's about an $8 million impact. So overall, we think that if all school districts did this, there would be about a $52 million cost to the state on a 100% basis. Currently, about 44% of all of the kindergartners in the state are in an all-day, everyday K program that's provided free of charge. We're budgeting based on the assumption that about two-thirds of the school districts would choose to implement this and about one-third would choose to stay with what they're doing right now. So that would get us up to about an 80% participation rate in this program And the governor's budget is based on the assumption that we'd be at about 80% the first year, with then about a 3% growth in the years after that, as a few more districts kind of take care of some of the bugs and add additional schools or sections to the program. The next governor's recommendation is the Governor's Excellence in Education Award, and that would be a $7 million annual cost. The first year it's $4.9 million because of the 70-30 funding provisions that we have. I also have a computer run that's a portrait that shows the schools that would qualify for this based on the 2010 data. So this is a computer run that says Governor's Award for Excellence in Education. That was, if you can locate that one. This money, and let me find the page. This is page, trying to find this one. This is page 10 of the bill, Governor's Award for Excellence in Education. And what this would do would be to provide additional funding and award to roughly the top 20% of the schools in the state based on their gains that are made by students under the growth model that we have developed using the MCA2s. And so what we've done is rank ordered all the schools in the state based on their percentage of students that make high growth, as defined currently in state law, and the money would be targeted to the top 392 schools out of about 2,000 schools that we have in the state. And those the numbers for those 392 schools are listed on this run. Now, this run is actually based on the 2010 results. The funding would be based on 2011, so we don't actually know for sure who would qualify. This is just based on what would have happened if we had implemented this in the current year rather than next year. So what this is showing you is how this formula would work, and there's basically two parts to it. Every school that has more than 40% of their students with high growth would qualify for $30 per pupil for every student in the school. On top of that, a school would qualify for additional money based on how far they are above 40%. So if the school is making high growth with 50% of their students, they'd get a little bit larger award than if they have 40% of the students making high growth. And the formula that's proposed for this in the bill would be that we would fund $30 for every student in the school plus $160 times the difference between 40% and the growth level for the students. So if they were at 50%, you take $160 times 10%, that'd be another $16 per student. So they would get $46 instead of the $30 per student. So it's kind of a sliding scale where we're identifying those schools that are being very successful in terms of moving kids along and then providing a little bit of an extra bump if they're being very successful. Now, the way that the bill reads, the half of the grant, or up to half of the grant, could be used at the school to maintain the high performance that they have. And part of this is assessing what are we doing right, and studying that and identifying kind of some best practices. The other half of the dollars would be used for disseminating those best practices to other schools, either in the district or in neighboring districts, or it could be across the state as well. So what this computer run shows, there's an example for the Armitage Elementary School in Minneapolis in the upper left-hand corner. And they've got 525 students enrolled. Since they're over there, they have 46% of those students are making high growth. So their basic grant, $30 times the 525 students, would be $15,000. Because they're at 46% rather than 40%, they're getting another $5,500. So that's a total of $21,000. And then because we're capping this at $7 million, we're using 99.8%. So bottom line is they would be getting $21,281. And what we show here, this is in school district number order, the schools at each district that would have qualified based on last year's test results. And this could change from year to year depending on how well they're doing in that particular particular year. So you can go through this, and you'll see that there are schools across the state, small schools, large schools, schools with a lot of poverty, schools without a lot of poverty, that are qualifying for this particular particular grant. And Commissioner, if you may want to add.
You did a great job. Yep. It's a non-competitive grant, so it comes to you as long as you're willing to share your best practice with other schools. Yeah, it's complicated because it's based on growth and actual multiple years.
Madam Chair and members, the Finance Department just shared with me the details on the charter school. You'd had a question earlier. If I could just briefly go back to that.
Thank you.
So the federal planning and implementation grants are up to $540,000 per school over a period of up to 3 years. There's a pre-operational planning grant of up to $180,000. First-year implementation, $180,000. Second-year of implementation, $180,000. So as you can see, these are quite a bit larger than the charter school startup aid in Minnesota, based on our formula, is the greater of $50,000 or $500 times the number of pupil units at the charter school. So they could get more than $50,000 if they were a relatively large charter school.
So, but Dr. Melcher, did you say that $50,000 over 2 years or $50,000
each year? $50,000 each year for
each
2 years.
Thank you.
Yes. So the federal portion would be continued, and the state portion would be sunset under the governor's proposal. The next recommendation of the governor would be a $3 million per year Achievement Gap Innovation Fund, and that is covered on page 11 of the bill. This would be a grant of up to $100,000 per year. It would be a competitive grant, and I'd like the commissioner to speak more on this one.
Sure. This is a grant specifically to spawn innovation and spur innovation around the achievement gap in particular. As a state, I don't think we've ever legislated dollars specifically for closure of the achievement gap solely. I know that we've put dollars on integration, but we have not done it specifically. What we want to be able to do with these dollars is work much like the federal fund, the I-3 grants, which also are targeted toward closing the digital divide for students. This is especially useful for our greater Minnesota families and students who don't have access to technology and infrastructure. And so this would be able to help them create greater infrastructure and connectivity for kids to be able to use technology in their learning. So this grant is competitive. We will have set aside so that we can have this grant throughout the state, so that we can look at innovative practices. And then what we want to do is there's going to be an evaluation component to each of those so that we get the information back on which practices in this innovation were successful, and then we look at scaling those up through our awards program. So these two programs work nicely together to reward excellence, spur innovation, and focus on closing the achievement gap for our students.
Madam Chair and members, the next
recommendation. Madam Chair, if I may, I have a question about this.
Senator,
thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, I wanted to share with you, I know you've been meeting a lot of people and meeting a lot of us, and we've been giving you messages that, you know, about the different work that we're doing here, but I wanted to make sure you knew in my second year here, I introduced a bill to address the achievement gap. And we work in a bipartisan way, both in the House and the Senate. We work with 47 superintendents in the University of Minnesota, brought in CSL, the Roy Wilkins Center, to really look at how can we support the efforts of the districts and what is that the state needs to do. And out of these efforts, a lot of the language you have here is very consistent with what they think that we need to do. So this is a very good step in the right direction. They particularly the superintendents came and say, you know, a lot of the concepts around achievement gap in the No Child Left Behind effort of the federal government was introduced. Those concepts were good, but the states were never given an opportunity to design these plans and never given an opportunity to plan and funding to do it, and that was problematic, and we learned the lesson. So if we could move in a direction through which you can give the districts an opportunity to look at how to do it and give them an incentive to be creative. So this is very much in line with what they said, and I have those records of those hearings. So I'm very excited about this proposal that you bring before us. There is a very small component that was added to that bill that I authored in 2007, and it was that they felt that we had to put some parameters around and be very specific with the language about research, because we know that there are certain practices that actually work and that we cannot leave it so vague so that then we are disappointed that they didn't do what we said it was supposed to be done. And I have that in the bill. I would love to offer that as an amendment when the time comes. And that was reviewed extensively, as I said, nationally, and I presented in Washington a couple of times. And basically, it has the seven components that have been recognized nationally as key components to address achievement gap from pedagogy. And so I would be very interested in having that conversation with you if you're interested.
Madam Chair?
Commissioner.
Thank you, Senator. I'm excited to know that this is in alignment with some of the efforts that you've worked with other school districts on. We really do hope to spur innovation around new strategies, as well as in the Governor's Award for Excellence, scale up those that are research-based and really working. So we hope to be able to do both of those.
Madam Chair and members, the next recommendation by the governor has to do with the statewide early childhood rating system. The governor is recommending a biennial appropriation of $2 million in the current biennium and then carrying tails of $2 million in the next biennium for the early childhood quality rating and improvement system. This would fund classroom observation of teachers and feedback as part of the proposed statewide early quality rating system. The last recommendation of the governor is a small change relating to the LEP funding formula. It appears on page 1 of the bill. We have a provision in current law which specifies that students who are in grades 4 or above, in order to qualify for LEP funding, must have taken the T-test, the Test of Emerging Academic English, and failed to show proficiency in English on the test. We currently have about 50 students who are severely handicapped who are unable to take the test, and because right now they're not taking the test, they don't qualify for LEP funding. What this would do would be to provide an exemption for them so that we would fund those 50 students, and that's about a $50,000 a year item. That's the last of the governor's recommendations, and bottom line, as I said, if you net out the reductions and the increases, we're at about a $23 million net increase in the current biennium and about a $95 million net increase in the tails, in addition to the impact of the payment shift changes. So with that, Madam Chair, we would be happy to answer. Oh, there is one other thing. I think there's language in Article 2. That deals with the reading well by third grade that I think the commissioner will want to go over.
Yeah, Madam Chair.
Commissioner.
It is not a fiscal note, but we did want to highlight that part of our policy, part of the bill, is policy language around the original 2001 reading bill. And we do have additional changes in this starting on page 5. Around literacy for students from early childhood all the way through kindergarten and third grade. And this provides for further accountability to school districts in their reporting to the State Department, also requires them to provide intervention. It requires professional development for teachers in effective reading strategies, cultural competence, and ELL strategies if your school has ELL students. And then it also requires the commissioner to provide professional development at the State Department for pedagogy content standards and dissemination of our content standards, as well as ensuring that all students have appropriate intervention plans in place in terms of accountability. So I just wanted to point that out in terms of reading well by third grade and putting in a few more provisions in the reading bill.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Madam Chair.
Your questions? Senator Stump.
I just wanted to point out on page 15, a section that's dear to your heart, subdivision 15.
Page, what page?
Page 15.
Yes.
Thank you.
And Madam Chair, I would add that the appropriations throughout the bill are reflecting current law as adjusted for the 70-30 payment schedule. So anything that we didn't mention on this one-page sheet that's included in current law is funded in the governor's budget at the 70-30 level as opposed to the 90-10.
And also funded at last year's levels.
Thank you. Are there questions? None? Well, thank you very much.
Madam Chair, I'd like to thank you for your leadership in hearing our bill today. And as I discussed, it is a bill focused on children, closing achievement gaps as its top priority, raising excellence and raising the bar for all children so that they read by third grade. It rewards excellence, and it also spurs innovation. And we are quite excited about this bill, Madam Chair, and I look forward to working with you and the governor and seeing how we might be able to get better achievement for all our kids in Minnesota. Thank you so much.
Madam Chair.
Senator Bonner.
I just couldn't let the moment go by with no comments. So that would be unlike me.
Exactly.
So, Commissioner, thank you for bringing forward the bill. Thank you, Senator Stump, Dr. Melcher, and I particularly like the emphasis on early education. As you know, I would like it to be more flexible to also include optionally 3- and 4-year-olds, but maybe we'll get there. I also like the idea of giving school districts an incentive for growth, because I think that directs us in the direction where we need to go, which is a focus on achievement. So thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And
thank you very much. Thank you very much. Senator Han, I think he's here. Oh, yes, he's good. Right here.
I wish we just could do something.
Senator Han is here to present Senate File 618, which we didn't get to yesterday. And I would like to just give some context for what we were going to do with this bill. We're going to hear from the author and hear from the St. Paul Public Schools, because they've expressed some concerns about this bill before this hearing. And so it's not our intent to take a great deal of testimony today, because the bill is a concept bill and will be considered in context with the other proposals that are floating around here in terms of addressing this issue. So why don't you proceed and tell us about your bill, Senator Han, and then we'll hear some testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And I know I appreciate your comment. This is a bill that I think is fairly described as a concept. It's something that I'll describe how this came about. But I'm wondering, Madam Chair, if just for purposes of clarity, I'd like to make an offer of an author's amendment to the bill.
Senator, I think we may have, there may have missed, have you all got the bill? I didn't either, so
thank you.
It appears to have been missed putting in our pack. So we'll wait until you get a copy of the bill, and then Senator Han, you can proceed.
I think this is, we have had a chance to hear the governor's proposal around this idea and the grant for innovation. So I think this gives us a chance to have some discussion on how tying education, you're approaching tying education funding to reading proficiency and progress. So I think this is a good time to hear this in juxtaposition and appreciate your
thank you
raising the issue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And if members have a copy of the bill, the amendment I'd like to offer, oral amendment, is on page 12, the last page of the bill, lines 12.1 and 12.2. We have some dollar amounts for 2012 and 2013, and I would offer just that those be stricken. And I think typically when we do these things, we just make a dashed line or whatever we do, but to strike the dollar amounts on lines 1 and 12.1 and 12.2. That would be my amendment.
Okay. All in favor of that motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Amendments adopted.
Thank you. Members, this really came about partly out of some of the things that Chairman Olson has talked about this year and previous years about reading and the importance of reading. I think we've all heard in various ways in this committee at various times how important reading is. I recall seeing some information, I think, Mr. Bartholomew brought, showing a almost one-to-one relationship between proficient reading at grade 3 and then graduation, high school graduation later on. It was remarkable that the percentage of kids that were reading at proficient levels in grade 3 almost tied exactly to the number of percentage of kids that graduated 9 years later. And in the course of thinking about that, and there's, of course, talk about the funds that we have and reform of the funding. We talk about that every year, how to reform the formulas and do things better and make sure the money gets used appropriately. We had a discussion about integration revenue a few days ago. And I asked Mr. Nauman if he would, for purposes of information, provide a run of data, which he kindly did, and I've asked him to do a sort of a brief run for the members of the committee that would show school districts that are represented by members of the committee, and that's the data run that you have. And what this shows is the top line on the first page is just the total for the state, and then it has the various school districts down the left-hand side. It shows enrollment. Columns B and C show the total free lunch and reduced lunch enrollment, and those are there because those are the numbers that drive the compensatory aid formula. So column D shows the total free and reduced lunch enrollment, and then column E is a percentage. So it shows for every school district as well as the state what is the percentage of students in that district that qualify for free and reduced lunch. And again, those are the base numbers that drive the formula for compensatory aid. Column F shows the compensatory aid per the top line of the first page is for the state on an annual basis, not a biennial, but annual, so $430.6 million annually, at least according to this run. And then each school district underneath that. It also has, in the full run, charter schools as well. And then column G is just a simple math showing the compensatory aid per student enrolled in the district. Columns H through J is a, I asked Mr. Nauman if he would show the number of students in third grade and the number who are not at proficiency, and then show a percentage in column J. And then K through M is a similar sort of display that has to do not with reading in grade 3, but math at grade 6. And what I wanted to look at was just the relationship between the money that we have that is being funded to schools to provide assistance to help deal with, I assume, among other things, achievement, although I'm not quite sure in the statute that there's anything specified in particular with compensatory aid. And some to try to give an idea of what the magnitude of some of the key issues in achievement might be. In other words, if you have students that are not reading at a proficient level by grade 3, that's probably a fair indication that there's an issue. There's a problem that's going to manifest itself later on. We all talk about learn to read the first 3 grades of school, read to learn after that. I threw in the sixth grade math proficiency, again, just as a gauge of what is the level of proficiency at sixth grade on our standardized test scores with mathematics. And I think that there's I've tried to go through. I haven't done a complete detailed analysis of all the whole system, but there are some school districts that have a very high percentage of free and reduced lunch and a very high percentage of proficiency on reading and math, and there are some that don't. And so there's not, and as I said, I haven't done a scatter plot diagram or something to try to find out what the relationship is between those things. But I think if you look at the data and if you look at school districts that you may represent, you could probably see some of these things as you go through. To look at the amount of students that are in that free and reduced lunch category, the amount of aid that they generate to the school district through the compensatory aid formula, and then the performance at third grade and sixth grade on proficiency levels. And it was looking at those numbers that led me to think about, well, what if we could find a way to take this money, or at least some part of it, and really target it to solve that problem? Let's assume, for the sake of argument, that at least some districts have got a recognized need in trying to get more students to be proficient by third grade. And there's money out there that is arguably there to try to help resolve that problem. So the bill is really an attempt to try to say, how do we focus on that? And the structure of the bill, what we have is, first of all, that we would establish a grant program. And the grant program, at least in my idea, would be funded by monies from the compensatory aid formula. So this is not an additional expense. It's repurposing existing funding. And so the qualification for a grant, in this case for reading, would be a district that has students that are that has at third grade less than 90% of their students reading proficiently. If you're a school district that has 90% or more of your students in third grade reading proficiently, then you would not be eligible for this grant, at least the way this is written. So if you have a school district where you have more students that are not reading at a proficient level, then you would qualify for the grant. And I've left the definition of what that grant has to do pretty open. It's silent. It doesn't say what the school district has to propose, just that they have to propose to the commissioner, the Department of Education, make a proposal to say how they will address this problem so that over a course of 3 years, they would have students, 90% of the third graders reading at proficiency. That's the goal. So the project would be for a school district, if you had some money and your goal was after 3 years to have third graders, 90% of them at least reading proficiently, what would you do? Write up a grant proposal, send it to the department. The department then would review those and approve grants based on their judgment of how effective that would be. It's very wide open. I don't say what has to be in the grant, or you know, I don't suggest it could be one thing or another. It's pretty wide open. The way we structured this, and I've debated this with Mr. Cook about, we've had it as a series of one-year grants that would call for some level of increasing performance. That may be too cumbersome. Maybe it's a three-year grant. I'm open to the structure. But the idea is to try to provide a way to encourage districts to think about what do we have to do to move kids to be proficient in reading by third grade. If you look at Subdivision 4 on page 2, this is a key part of this as well, starting on lines 2.5. I served on a school board. I know one of the things that school districts are challenged with is that there's all kinds of things that we ask schools to do. All kinds of curriculum, all kinds of mandates, all kinds of expectations. And I've heard, when I was on the board, many times the complaint, there's only 8 hours in the day, or there's only whatever number of hours a day, and you keep adding things, adding expectations, adding requirements for us to do more and more, but there's only so many hours in the day. How do we do all that? So what this language does in Subdivision 4 is essentially say that if you have kids that cannot read at proficient level, you don't have to do anything except teach them to read. It relieves the school district of any other obligation that we have in law other than the fact that they should teach them to read. And here again, my argument is simply that if you can't have kids reading at a proficient level by third grade, then it's debatable whether they're ever going to get caught up, whether they're ever going to get to a point where they can achieve. So if we don't focus and make sure that we get kids reading at a proficient level by third grade, then what good is it doing to teach them how to do art or social studies or phi ed or even math? Why not make sure that they can read? And if we do that, then at least you have an opportunity in subsequent years if there is a need to catch up in other areas, that there's an opportunity to do that. Now, it doesn't require that the schools do that. It says that they may teach other things, but what the point of this is to relieve them of any other mandates that they may feel would get in the way of whatever grant idea they have to get the focus on getting kids to read. Section 2 of the bill is sort of on the other side of this. If after a specified period of time, and as I said, we've been talking about the structure of the grants, whether it's a three-year or what happens, and this is a concept, it's a sort of a work in progress. But at some point you might say, well, if you're not being successful, then let's allow that money that we're purposing for grants to teach kids to read, let's make that money available to families of these students to use as a way to go to another school. We call an access grant. Some of you who are here a few years know that I had a bill a few years ago that had an access grant structure. This is very similar to that. I think, in fact, some of the language in this bill is identical to the language in that bill. And what that simply does is allow families of students to have a certain amount of money made available that they could take with them to any accredited school, public or private, for purposes of education. And it does have some conditions that are stated at the top of page 3 and who would qualify for that. Other than that, I think that's really essentially the heart of the bill. We did have the part that I deleted in the opening amendment was just a suggested appropriation amount. It was arbitrary, just pick a number. I'm not suggesting that be done because that may be something that the committee would want to consider or may want to do some other things with. But that's really what this is doing. It's proposing to take money that we are currently using and repurposing it and trying to find a way to focus. And I'll tell you, one of the things that also prompted this in my thinking was years ago when I served on the school board and was involved in a negotiating session with our teacher bargaining unit, and we were talking about different things. And one of the teachers said, why can't we just focus on reading and just make sure that by the time they're in fourth grade, every kid can read? And I said, well, that's a great idea. Why can't we do that? And then we started talking about all the things that get in the way, all the things that we have to do, and all the other. And it really, to me, seemed apparent that this is a problem that we recognize, but for some reason, we're not finding a way to focus on solving that problem. And that also was in my mind as I thought about how we could do that. So the concept is to repurpose, and I'm using for, in this case, some portion of the compensatory aid to focus on areas, maybe reading and math, and ask schools to come up with whatever they think works, and then ask that those be funded and have the gauge for performance be the proficient score on a third grade reading test, or if it's a math, maybe a math test at some point. And so, Madam Chair and members, that's really what the bill is. As I said, I think there are some things in this bill that if we were going to adopt it, I would argue we would still need to work on. This has been with the tight deadlines for the early deadlines for budgets, I know we're all kind of under pressure to work things out here, but I thought that the idea was at least worthy to be brought here for some talk about how we might do this, or if we might want to do it. And so, Madam Chair, that's my presentation, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Senator Hand. You know, I reflect on the idea that you can teach just reading, but remember that when you're learning to read, you are reading words. It's really hard to separate other learning. You can learn when you're other things when you're learning to read. And obviously, learning to read encompasses everything from the phonics and phonemic awareness all the way to vocabulary and comprehension. And those are in context that you will learn. But I think what the importance is, don't lose sight of the fact that the underlying need to learn to read is the essential one.
Absolutely.
Thank you. We've got some testimony from St. Paul. Mary Gilbert, would you bring your folks up and introduce them? And
Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, if I might ask Senator Hand.
Sure.
And
come. Go ahead.
I apologize, but I'm having trouble with that count below proficiency and percent below proficiency. And it's kind of the reverse of what I intuitively think. Do we mean above? Or just percent at proficiency?
Madam Chair and Senator Scheid, no. This means that, for example, if you look at the top line, it means that for the state, in third grade, 23% of our students are below proficient across the state.
Okay.
Or if you go down to the first line, which happens to be Minneapolis Public Schools, 45.9% are below proficient.
Okay.
That's the percentage. The number to the left in column I is the actual count. Now, that represents, and Mr. Nauman can correct me, that's just third grade. So you're getting a snapshot of third grade students, and in this particular year, I think it's 2010 is the data year.
Madam Chair, I understand that. I guess maybe I get lost with the M, well, I don't know if it's K or the M column, thank you. The L/K percent below proficiency. That seems counterintuitive, but maybe I'm...
Well, and Madam Chair and Senator Scheid, the columns K through M have to do with math
yes.
proficiency by uh-huh. sixth grade. Columns H through J is reading proficiency. So it's two different areas, but the idea is the same, that we're trying to show how many students are not proficient. And the reason we did that is we said that you would be qualifying for a grant if you did not have 90% proficiency.
And Madam Chair?
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry to take so long, and I may be just being thick, but I'm looking at schools like Wayzata, Minnetonka, mm-hmm. Orono, and they have a very high below proficiency compared to schools that just is throwing me.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid.
On page one.
They appear to have for math, they are not for the reading part.
Yes, I understand.
Yeah. I'm not sure I
grasp
that either. Unless it's the sixth grade is, depends on what we're measuring at sixth grade in relation to what's being taught by that time. I don't know if that's what that's a factor of. Or what, Senator Hand?
Well, Madam Chair, I might want to, if I could ask Mr. Nauman to comment. I asked him to do the runs, and maybe he can explain more clearly than I have.
Well, Madam Chair and members, it might be helpful to think about that. Traditionally, we think about this at a site level, and Senator Hand, so we would be computing the proficiency at a site level. What we're doing here is rolling it all up into a district-level calculation, so that might create some distortions beyond what you might normally be thinking about.
But Mr. Chairman, there's like at Orono, for example, has one elementary school and one, middle school. So it's not the site factor, but it does seem a little odd. I know what Orono is done in the reading area, but...
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Sieben.
I was just wondering, when I read it, I interpreted it as the percentage is the percentage of just the free and reduced lunch that's at proficiency. And that's different than the overall population of the district. And I don't think that you clarified that in your... Or I don't know if that's right, but that's the way I interpreted it. And there's obviously would be a difference then in the percentage. It's rather significant, I would imagine. That would make sense.
Mr. Nauman, that was not...
Madam Chair and members, I'll just tell you about the operations of the math. Under column E, we do a free and reduced lunch percentage of the total free and reduced lunch enrollment divided by the total enrollment. So in the case of Minneapolis, you're getting a 65.6% based on that math. Then under column J, a similar operation is performed. So you're dividing the column I into column H, and that gives you a percentage of the count below proficiency relative to the total count that was tested in the district. And then we do the same math in column M, mm-hmm. but at this time we're doing the count below proficiency versus the count tested L divided by K.
And
Madam Chair, you're not, as Senator Sieben was, I think,
translating that we were measuring. It's not the ones that are in free and reduced price lunch that you're measuring. It's the whole third grade population.
Well, yeah, I don't think that what we're not doing here is an additive calculation. I think what Senator Hand asked was to have an eyeball comparison, and that's why we put big bold lines down the middle of the page to sort of separate
well,
the groups.
Senator Hand and Mr. Nauman, I think this does point out that,
because it's not that many tested,
this being on free and reduced price lunch doesn't mean that you're not
exactly
going to be able to read.
Right. Madam Chair.
There will be other factors and other categories of people or other circumstances that.
Right. Madam Chair and Mr. Nauman's point, what these are, the count tested is, and for example, in the columns H through J, the count tested is the number of third graders tested for reading proficiency. So to Orono, suggests there's 183 third graders who were tested at least in 2010, and 23 of them did not score proficient, which means that 12.6% of the students at third grade in Orono who were not proficient in reading. So based on my language of the bill, your school would qualify to receive a grant to try to focus on those 23 kids. And the argument would be that may be a fairly constant number year by year. I don't know. We haven't looked at that over time.
Senator Scheid, well, district I live in is West Tonka, the one right above it, which is always competing with Orono, and it's kind of interesting to see that they're doing better than Orono.
Well,
reading, yes.
And it strikes me that the next reading, we're going to be talking about math, because look at that. I mean, you've got almost an 80, go from 12.6% not proficient in reading in third grade, and in sixth grade math, you're almost 80%.
Exactly.
So is that there, just really, and then I look great. At.
Is there a chance, that percentage column in M might have been the reverse, that we're proficient rather than below proficiency?
Madam Chair, I can check that while we're sitting here.
I'll just
confirm it. I don't think so, but let me.
The face validity of it is somehow missing here for.
Well, and Madam Chair, I looked at those numbers and they did seem high, but my recollection is that our proficiency levels in reading always seem to be higher than our proficiency levels in math. So it struck me that there would be a higher percentage of non-proficient math students than reading. But we also tend to focus a lot on reading and not so much on math when we talk about performance. And so, I mean, to be honest with you, I had not really looked at this before I asked Mr. Nauman to be the
center.
Senator Nelson. Madam Chair, I too was bothered by this column M and the large percent that appeared to be below proficiency in math. And I was wondering, I just need some clarification from those of you who were here before. Did we not change our math standards recently? And I thought that perhaps our students had actually been tested with the new math standards and the math tests, and yet they had not had the teaching to back that up. And I'm just wondering if that applies here.
I'm just told that the assessments changed this year, so that may not
did not apply to these numbers then. Thank you.
It doesn't appear so, but we could all stand corrected. We're kind of pooling our ignorance up here on this account. So if somebody can help us from the audience, Mr. Shackleton probably has all of the answers on this account from the department, so we'll.
But part of the
Senator
I guess
Hand.
The point that I was trying to make is that across the state, $430 million a year is compensatory aid funding. But we still have a fairly significant, and maybe we've not got the numbers exactly right in Mr. Nauman's data, although my experience with Mr. Nauman is pretty accurate. So, but you still have a very high number, large number, significant number, in both reading and math at certain grade levels that are benchmark levels where we're not getting proficiency. And it would seem to me that you've got a large resource there that is there to be targeted for some purpose that I would argue should be to make sure we're doing things to focus on achievement, and we still have a pretty big problem. And so my point is to the argument that we don't have any focused application of those funds, this may be an opportunity for us to ask how do we focus that. And my bill will be a thought on how to do that.
Let's hear from some of the folks that are here. Who wants to start? You'd introduce yourself for the record.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair,
committee members. I'm Michael Bauman. I'm the Chief Business Officer for St. Paul Public Schools, and thank you for the opportunity to speak before you today. I'm here to speak against the dramatic changes to compensatory education funding as proposed in SF 618. I'm not here to talk about maintaining the status quo. You heard recently from our superintendent, and I know she didn't talk to you about maintaining a status quo. In St. Paul Public Schools over the past few years, we have worked very hard to close underperforming programs. We've expanded successful programs so that more students can be served better by those programs. We know we need to bring those changes to scale and raise achievement for all of our students. Last night, you may have heard in the news, our Board of Education passed our Strong Schools, Strong Communities strategic plan, and we're focused on achievement, and that's goal number one, closing that achievement gap. We're realigning our programming and our transportation operation to cut expenses while still providing the regional citywide magnets and ensuring some choice, all the while shifting some of the focus back toward our community schools. We're planning for long-term sustainability by institutionalizing things such as zero-based budgeting methodology for central administration and our budget planning in that area. We're putting in place a robust, multi-tiered, leader-accountable performance management system that is business intelligence-based, that will keep our attention on our goals and progress toward them at every level of the organization through business-like metric and reporting systems. Now, based on our current state investments, we're expecting an approximately $20 million shortfall as we look at fiscal year 12 budget. The cumulative shortfalls we've had to cover in St. Paul Public Schools since 2006 to our current projection totals, $95.4 million. We're pursuing some very deliberate reductions in expenditures with the Strong Schools, Strong Community plan, as well as pursuing very deliberately efforts to increase our enrollment. We think the combined effect is going to improve our financial situation within the district. But note, this is predicated on an ambitious improvement in our enrollment situation. We still need to make cuts, even with that plan, and even with our state funding remaining the same. A compensatory education, as with other state investments in our students, is absolutely critical to moving forward on the plan we've set to close this achievement gap that has persisted. We will work to increase efficiency across our entire system. Currently, this funding represents 15% of our general fund. Without it, our instructional interventions would be severely limited, and class sizes would go up dramatically. Removing the support for the students who are at the low end of the achievement gap based on our staff analysis. To remove such a significant source of funding now would undercut our efforts to set the institutional conditions for increased accountability, for the efficiencies that we need to leverage, and most importantly, our ability to close the achievement gap. Today, with me are two principals who can give us some examples about how they use CompEd to raise achievement for all students. And I'm going to pass the mic to Dr. McCullough.
Dr. McCullough, welcome.
Great. Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Senators, thank you, Mr. Bauman. First of all, welcome to the neighborhood. My name is Mike McCullough. I'm the principal at Washington Technology Magnet. We're 2 miles up Rice Street from here, so you're actually in our attendance area. Washington, we're in the old Arlington building. When they closed Arlington High School last year, we were at the old Washington High School site with about 750 students. This year, we expanded to a 7th through 10th grade program. We have about 1,130 students. Next year we'll add 11th grade. Next year we'll add, or the following year we'll add 12th grade. And I'm here to tell you about some of the exciting things that are going on at Washington. I want to first thank you for the work you're doing in helping improve student education in Minnesota. Yes, we want to close the achievement gap, but it's also about making Minnesota a world-class state with a world-class education system. Yes, we're going to be working on the closing the achievement gap, but we're also looking at Singapore. We're also looking at some of the Asian countries, trying to figure out what can we do, because we know that the key to success is not going to be waiting for India or China or Japan. The key to success is going to be helping our students, whether they're disadvantaged students, our regular students, or our advanced students, move on to that next level. And so part of the reason that I'm here is I'd like to not only tell you a little bit about what we're doing at Washington, but invite you to stop up any time. Again, I know you're busy at this time of the year, but just 2 miles up the road on Rice Street, you're more than welcome to see what we're doing at any time. First of all, improving student education really isn't that hard, right? All you do is you have great teachers and you have a system of success for students. Kind of like saying the budget problem at the state isn't very difficult. You just take the money in and you spend it. And when you balance the two, then the budget problem is solved, right? But the system of success is where compensatory aid is really critical at Washington and in the St. Paul Public Schools. Because we think we have great teachers. We have had the opportunity over the last few years through the AYP-NCLB program to select the very best teachers that to work with our students. So we're confident that we have the very best teachers at Washington working with the most disadvantaged students. But as far as developing a system of success, it's all based on data. We use a data teams approach where, for example, and I'll use math as an example, we have the grade level teams working in math. So for example, our seventh grade math team, I was just sitting in on a meeting yesterday with them. They define which of the state standards are power standards. They meet around common instructional goals. They develop common assessments. And then for students who are not proficient in those assessments, they provide interventions. We provide interventions during our homeroom time as well as during our extended day program. At Washington, we're able, because of compensatory revenue, to offer extended day to every kid every day. So right now, our students are just getting out of their extended day program. We have 1,130 students participating in extended day programming every day. That's how you close the achievement gap. It's about time for students, and it's about time for teachers to work together and figure out what the assessments are, figure out what the standards are, the assessments are, and then the interventions. The interventions are going to be different for each student. Some students, it's a language issue. Some students, it's a motivation issue. Some students, it's providing time to do their homework because there isn't a quiet place for them to do homework at home. But again, all of those things take time. Time translates to money. With the compensatory revenue, I'm able to hire more teachers, which, again, provide more time for students in the extended day program, as well as time for teachers to meet during the day. Again, I'm going to yield the floor to my colleague from Phelan Park Elementary School, but would be happy to answer any questions afterwards.
Thank you, Mr. Bowman.
Good afternoon. Ms. Rich? Can you hear me all right, or do I need to slide? My name is Catherine Rich. I'm principal of Phelan Lake Hmong Studies Magnet. We are located on the east side of St. Paul, East Side Pride. I'd like to also just kind of echo what Dr. McCullough has said in terms of the data, that conversations that you're talking about that's going on. Teachers from pre-K to sixth grade are having the same sort of conversations, analyzing student performance, looking at their work, differentiating instruction. But in addition, I'd like to talk to you about some of the unique aspects of my school. 80% of my students are English language learners. 92% of those students receive free and reduced lunch. We have the privilege and the opportunity of being what is known in St. Paul as a language academy site, where we invite and have special programming for new arrivals, students who are new to the country, who are in our particular school. The preponderance of those new arrivals are refugee students, in which case for most, if not all of those students, their very first experience of a formal classroom, a structure such as a school, is when they come into our doors and are welcomed into their classrooms. Compensatory dollars are a vital part of the funds that allow us to do what we're doing at our school. I have the opportunity to have over 11 ELL teachers in addition to 8 paraprofessionals, most of whom are bilingual. We search out working with the first language of our students, as well as the best practices and strategies, as were mentioned in the bill, and looking at what are strategies that English language learners need in order to effectively access the curriculum that they're expected to learn. I want to take, just looking briefly at some of the scores that we were talking about, we have 85% of our students off your MCA data have made medium to high growth in math and 81% medium to high growth in reading. We made, which we were in continuing the practices, 11% gains in our MCA math scores, actually making AYP status in math. All of our subgroups, including our Federal Setting 3 special ed population, made proficiency in math. In reading, we were able to make 7% gains. We could break down in looking at the data in one particular subgroup. We know it was one student with missing one item on a test that prevented that subgroup from moving forward. Also, it was in our special ed subgroup that did not make proficiency in reading. But aside from it, to be able to look at, we have significant growth going on. The compensatory dollars are used to provide staff that are deeply committed to providing what our students need so that they are proficient, so that they are literate. I would like to say are literate by third grade, but I have fourth, fifth, and sixth grade students, new arrivals, six of which who have started in the last 2 weeks who are in fourth, fifth, and sixth grade and new to our school system. A year from now, they will be expected to be proficient in English, in math at grade six, or reading at grade six, fifth, on our state tests. So there's a complexity of variables that go in when we look at our data. I also would like you to extend the invitation, please, to come out and visit our school. You will find an extraordinary, vibrant learning community. Thank you.
Senator Daley, did you have...
Madam Chair.
I do, Madam Chair. Go ahead, Senator Hayes.
Madam Chair, I just would like to respond very briefly. I just want to make sure that our colleagues here from St. Paul, the bill, particularly after the amendment, is not removing any money. It's suggesting a repurposing of money, and numbers that we have, if St. Paul qualifies for compensatory, which it does, it would also qualify to receive money under this program as I have structured it, although it would be there for a different purpose. And I just want to make it clear that the goal here isn't to take money away. It is to ask the question whether the money can be purposed or directed to something that is measurable, something that we would perhaps all agree is a legitimate or an appropriate focus. I just think if we could get at least 90% of third graders every year to be proficient in reading, would we have an achievement gap? I don't know that we would. If that happened every year, year after year, 90% of third graders could read proficiently, and you did that for year after year after year, would there be an achievement gap? My own sense is there wouldn't be one. And so we have a large resource that I think is, I'm just asking the question, can it be, ought it to be redirected to something? It's not about trying to take money away from a school district, but to ask the question, can this resource be used in some way that is arguably more directed, more purposeful? So that's my comment.
Senator Daley?
Madam Chair, I'll withdraw the question just temporarily until we're all done with this particular bill. It relates to the previous bill, talking about the governor's budget.
Okay.
For education.
Madam Chair?
Are there questions that we have about this bill? Are questions of the witnesses? Senator Nelson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Hand, I just have a kind of a comment. First, I agree with the goal of making sure our kids are reading by third grade. And I think that's laudable, and I think it's good to focus our resources in that area. I guess I just have one question, and that's on page 2 and lines 2.30 and 2.31. And I'm actually just kind of curious, once they get to our goal of making sure that 90% of our students are proficient, then they're suddenly not eligible for the money. And so there's a couple things I'm thinking about. That's really kind of the opposite of rewarding good behavior. That's kind of like punishing good behavior. So I'm a little concerned about that. And then I'm just wondering about also, what if it was the interventions that they were doing that got them to that 90% level? And so while it looks like I understand everything else, it's just those two lines are making me wonder if we should do something else there. Maybe let them have full rein of how to use that money or something. In other words, you have more flexibility. If you've already done your job and you got kids reading, 90% of your kids reading at grade level, then we're no longer going to prescribe how you use that money. Just something for you to consider and maybe to comment on.
Madam Chair and Senator Nelson, that it's a good question. It is something that, as we did this draft and put this together, and in fact, Mr. Cook and I were talking a little bit about this the other day. I'm not sure that this is the thing to do. You could make the argument, well, once you learn how to do this, maybe you figure it out and maybe just keep doing it. Because as we say, and the data show, there are many districts that are apparently able mm-hmm. to do this, are successful. And they're doing it with current levels of funding and so on. So, but the other part of it is that maybe this structure isn't right. Maybe what you do is you say you continue to receive funding as long as you maintain that. I'm open to that. I'm not trying to suggest, and particularly this subdivision 5, we're talking about the structure of this grant. Okay. I think that's a part of the work that, as we were looking at this, we recognized needed some massaging to make it work right. But if we did this after a couple of years, we might have enough information to know how to do that to make it work. But it's a fair point.
Madam Chair?
Senator Nelson?
Just to follow up then. Do you want us, Madam Chair, to make amendments today, or is this just kind of an idea to lay over and work on before we see it again?
I think so, because I think we've got several things whirling around this. I'm excited that everybody is caught on to the notion that we got to have reading proficiency by third grade. But now it's almost overwhelming of all of the approaches of how we do get there. So,
Madam Chair, we don't need an amendment or anything at this point. So is that correct?
That's right. I think that's appropriate. Okay. And I'm just, if any of you have the lightning flash that say, aha, we definitely want to hear about it.
All right. So, thank you.
Great. And I'm not saying that you haven't had that lightning flash, but Senator Hahn, but nonetheless, I think I appreciate that, and I appreciate that people coming to the fore who are finding things that work. We've got to do even more of getting that communicated. So thank you very much for coming and testifying. And I'm not trying to ignore you. Jim Graswell is asked also to come and speak for Minneapolis. Oh, I'm sorry. Senator Harrington, do you want to speak before we?
Yes. Two things. Madam Chair, I just wanted to thank my colleagues from St. Paul. Mike and I worked at Washington Junior High back when it was the old building, and it was a tough school then. It's still a tough school. I think one of the things that we have to recognize is that not all schools, while all children are created equal, the schools that they go to are not necessarily. And when Mike and I worked at Washington Junior High, we were confronted with multiple gangs of delinquent youth. We had homicides within blocks of our building. We had guns in the school. We had lots of real challenges that not every other school district has. And so I know that while there's a sense that all kids should be treated the same, the means to get there, I think, sometimes can be lost. In the vision of equality, these schools are really facing some great challenges and overcoming some great challenges. And for my colleague over on Phelan, which is the east side where my district is, I know the east side right now is a tough place to run a school. And you know, to think about what it's like to try and start with a student who comes in, who came out of the Watt Monastery only a few months ago, who was living literally in a tin shack where they brought in bottled water in a guarded compound, and then to have them flown here, dressed, and ready for school, and then at the age that some of them come in, to hope that they're going to be ready for to really read by third grade, I think is quite the accomplishment. That she says to us that she will have them ready within a year of arrival, I think, is actually miraculous. When you think of the obstacles that the students, their parents, and that school has to overcome in order to achieve that goal. So I just wanted to say thank you to all of them for the hard work that they're doing.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Harrington. Senator Weaker?
Well, Madam Chair, it's going to be a part of the mix as we look at best ways of addressing the agreed-on goal of reading proficiency by third grade, and we've had testimony that Head Start, I believe, in St. Paul talked about second grade, and and things. Maybe we can be looking at some incentives in going back to the first presentation we had or so.
Yes, we've got the governor's proposal before us now. We've
right.
got several things.
But the one thing that I'm thinking about as we go through this, we started out, some of the proposals that have passed through here, we talked about being less prescriptive to school boards and to give them flexibility. And this certainly takes a different direction, and whether the consistency is important or not, but I just point that out.
Sure. Thank you. Senator Hand?
Just one comment. Mr. Nauman. He has brought to me a revised run, and there was an error on the data. The columns K are correct. The numbers in column K is correct. The math in column M is correct. But apparently the numbers in column L were picked up from another source, and so the revised version has smaller numbers, which would make the percentages lower, which may be a little bit more intuitively realistic. So I'm going to ask if Mr. Nauman might make copies of this for other members, and you can take a look at that.
Madam Chair, Senator Hamm already done so. This is we had just grabbed the complete reverse data. We had the proficiency as opposed to the not proficiency. I think some individuals speculated that. My compliments to Senator Scheid for picking that up.
Thank you.
So we'll hand that out.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Have a heart attack. Mr. Russell, thank you very much.
For you reading that chart like that.
Well, it was so counterintuitive that.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Jim Grafall. I represent the Minneapolis Public School, and I'd like to thank Senator Hand for bringing this bill forward. It's always a pleasure to work with or work against Senator Hand, frankly. And I've done.
What are we
both.
Doing now?
Well,
no.
I just want to say concentration of poverty matters. So I would urge you to make haste slowly. It matters in research shows this. Statewide test data show this. Your parents know this. It matters in Minneapolis. It matters in Eden Prairie. It matters in your communities. The issue is time. I just want to have a little break here. I did not coordinate my testimony with my St. Paul colleagues. Some students need more time to attain standards. In public education, time is money, time is staff, more intensive instruction, and smaller work groups. We tend not to dispute this when we talk about special education. We have students in Minneapolis and in your districts who cost $30,000, $60,000, $90,000 to get them to approach standards. And it's a civil right, and we're happy to do that. And part of that story is our special ed cross subsidy. We tend to understand it more when we talk about ELL or LEP students, when we know there's a language barrier. And in Minneapolis, after our 2003 cap on ELL spending, we're using some of our compensatory to make that piece words. When a student arrives at school with a vocabulary at 500 words versus 10,000, the issue is time. We understand the importance of being able to read by third grade, Senator. In fact, our early readiness programs, we've structured early readiness programs both on both sides of the river in Minneapolis and St. Paul because we have to start earlier. Four-year-old kindergarten, from early childhood screening at age 3 to four-year-old kindergarten programs in both sides of the river to all-day kindergartens. We're just announcing today, and I got a press release in the course of the day, that 30% of our kindergartners enrolled this year are at the end-of-year standard for kindergarten, 60% are on course for being there, and we'll keep working with the other 40%. So having early childhood interventions, four-year-old kindergarten, all-day kindergarten, and in Minneapolis last year, we spent $2.1 million of our compensatory on all-day K. This year, it's $3.3 million. These are effective investments for us. I just want to, we have gaps to standard in every grade. We have students coming to us with gaps of to standards in every grade. So the focus of the bill on resources in early childhood, while appropriate, we're going to still need resources to close gaps at every grade. Our students don't come to us in a 24-pack like a Coke's and move through. Those students are mobile, and they move from classroom to classroom, school to school, year to year. I just want to address the NCLB logic in the bill of you know, identifying the gap and closing it within 3 years. We were doing that under NCLB, dividing the gap by 10 years and the time it takes to achieve the gap. I'd urge you to listen to my colleagues in St. Paul who talk about what's going on both sides of the river right now. We get our student data. We take our our budget allocations of general ed, special ed, ELL, and compensatory. We look at what are the key investments we can make on the basis of our data to achieve the results that we want and move the needle on student achievement. Again, I think this is a good debate to have. I think I would encourage you not to presume that we're in Minneapolis or St. Paul or any other public school not focused on doing everything possible with these resources, which we know are scarce, to get the best results possible. Thanks for the opportunity, and I appreciate the senator's work in this area.
Thank you very much. Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Hahn and senators, I want to use this opportunity to bring something to your attention because many of our members are new. But I want you to look at this number that is in front of you for the Minneapolis School District. We have 34,000 children in the Minneapolis School District, and 20,000 of these children are children who live in poverty. They are free lunch enrollment. And if you look at the column in there, there is absolutely no other district that has a number that is close to that number. Absolutely none. So the next one that has a large number of children living in poverty is the Anoka-Hennepin Public School District, and that's 8,000. So Minneapolis has more than double that. And what I would like to reflect on with you, members, is on the opportunity that we have to really look at how we educate children who live in poverty. And I think that Senator Hahn actually brings to us a very important, I think, idea and very important bill. And he's saying, well, we spent all of this money and we ought to do better. Let me tell you this. Let's just say that we agree to invest all of this funding and we take all of this compensatory funding that is going to schools where we have a lot of poverty. Let's just say that. And we invest it all in reading because we think that today that's the thing that we're supposed to do, right? It's a good thing. And I'm not arguing against it. I'm not arguing against it. But let me almost guarantee you that in 2 or 3 years, you're going to come and say, well, why didn't we just kind of divide that between proficiency in math and science? Because we're competing with other countries, and we should have invested in science. Why are we just investing in reading? Well, let me tell you, a few years ago, people say, why don't we invest in poor kids? And we created this compensatory formula. And year after year, we create these formulas because the thing of the day is whatever. Today is reading. So we're trying to change one formula to put it into another. And what I would like to invite you to do is really to be more responsible and look at all of these formulas collectively. Because you can't, Senator Hahn, and you know this because you've been here, you can't separate these formulas. That simply, you know that. What Mr. Grathwell just said, you know, if you look at our children, our ELL population, and our child with disability, members, let me tell you, the numbers are just as big in Minneapolis. You cannot even compare the numbers that you have with children with disabilities. And I wish I had the table. I was trying to Google it, but I don't have connection. You don't have anything near the number that we have in Minneapolis with children with disabilities and ELL. Nothing. Compared to what we have. So we have to look at these formulas collectively and figure out, you know, what is happening in all of these districts. And I really want you to, I invite you to ask that question. How did we define these formulas? Why did Minneapolis get this and didn't get, what you know, what is concentration of poverty, concentration of ELL population, concentration of children with disability, and then figure out why is that we are not doing what we're supposed to do. We do have to ask the question, Senator. Let me tell you, and Jim knows this, I am so critical of Minneapolis, and I come to the schools every day and say, we are not doing the right thing. We receive more money than anybody else, and why are these numbers looking the way they are? But this is a tough, this is a challenging thing. So I hope that you would bring a bill before us that look at all of these formulas in a comprehensive way to look at how do we resolve this problem, because this problem goes beyond compensatory, beyond ELL, beyond high concentration of poverty, beyond the high concentration of certain children with disabilities in some districts. And I sincerely hope that you can do that.
Senator Torres-Ray, I was just looking at the at the chart that we have before us in Columbia Heights and Brooklyn Center and St. Paul have higher concentrations of poverty than Minneapolis. And I shouldn't do this, but St. Paul has done some, if you look at the percentages that have that are below proficiency, they're smaller than some of these others.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I think that I'm not talking about high concentration. No, I'm just talking about the volume.
Well,
because it's hard to.
Yeah, there's some of them are smaller. Is that magnitude of scale what that does? I think we need to be talking more about that. And I do hope that we can pursue that. Senator Cruz,
To that point, Madam Chairwoman and members, Senator Torres-Ray, you know, I share your passion for these students. I represent Anoka Hennepin, which also, as you mentioned, has a high number of students that are in that category. And I think what Senator Hahn is trying to do here is exactly what you're saying. Let's take a look at these. Let's adjust these. And I think what we're trying to point out in this graph is if you look, we really need to ask ourselves, are these dollars accomplishing the goals that we're attempting to achieve with them? If you look at Anoka Hennepin here, I mean, per pupil, we're spending over $1,300 more in the Minneapolis area with, again, it's a high number of these students. But then you look at some of these proficiencies here, and the proficiencies are much higher in those districts. So, you know, and I had a lot of respect for what Senator Harrington said, too. I think some of these schools do have extreme concerns, legitimate concerns. My question for this committee would be, are we insulating our schools? Are we insulating our children from these outside forces instead of actually going out and fixing the problems that need to be fixed? And if you talk about $800 million in a biennium, that's a lot of money. That's going to buy a lot of a gang task force. That's going to buy a lot of other things that we can do to maybe solve a problem. And I guess what I'm hearing from Senator Hahn is, are these dollars accomplishing the goals that we need them to accomplish? And I know that you and I have had multiple conversations about potentially getting a group together to discuss these formulas as a whole and try and do this. And I share your passion for that. And I just, you know, I guess that's where I'm coming from on this is, let's look at these and let's ask the questions: Are we doing the job for our children? Are we really giving them the best possible situation?
Senator Hahn?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I agree with Senator Torres-Ray. I've heard her speak many times in committee in previous years as well as this year about the need that we have to make sure that we are using money in the right way. And I think to her credit, she has been one of the proponents of taking a close look at formulas and asking those hard questions that sometimes we don't ask. And I support that. And I think part of what my bill is suggesting is, first of all, that we don't do this by formula, but we do this by what is a problem that we have, how do we know if we're solving it, and then targeting resources to try to focus on that in a way that can be objectively measured. And that was one of the reasons why I focused on reading. We've talked a lot about reading, but we can measure it. We do it very well. We have a very clear understanding of, going back to the comment made earlier about Mr. Bartholomew's correlation between third grade reading and graduation. So you have a problem, you have a way to measure it, we've got a resource. What if you focused it? I did some quick math, and if you took the entire compensatory aid for the state and focused it on just making sure third graders could read, you'd have over $40,000 per student per year. You could hire a teacher for every one of them if you wanted to do that, if you thought that was what it would take. But and I hear the other comments that there's more to it than just I agree. And so part of the thing that I was trying to structure in the bill was sort of a open door, let people come and make a proposal. I talked to Senator Nelson earlier, and she said, well, why don't we use some of this, if you're repurposing, why couldn't some of this be used for early childhood? And my bill doesn't say it couldn't be. It could be. If people thought early childhood was the way to get third graders to read, write a grant, say you're going to do it. But the other side of that, what I was trying to say, is that we should have some way to measure that if it isn't happening, then something should be done, that we can't just continue to allow a significant percentage of kids year after year after year to not be proficient, knowing that that really is what drives, in my view, what drives the achievement gap. I did want to ask counsel if they have it available to them. Is there anything in the statute, in the compensatory formula statute, that purposes the money? I looked at it, and I don't recall if there is a particular purpose for it. It's not like Title I, I don't think.
Just to start, Madam Chair, members, there is a list for what you can use the money for. Ms. McClay is getting the book.
Madam Chair, just to clarify while we're waiting, Senator Hand, thank you for bringing forth those comments that I made. I just wanted to clarify. Actually, I was talking about all-day kindergarten as opposed to early childhood.
I'm sorry.
Just wanted to get the term right. Thank you.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. Senator Nelson, you're right. I misspoke.
Madam Chair and Senator Han, the use of compensatory revenue is grouped together with basic skills, which is also LEP revenue. And the general statement is that it must be reserved and used to meet the educational needs of pupils who enroll and are prepared to learn. And then it goes on to list about 11 allowable uses, including direct instructional services, remedial instruction, teachers, longer school day, comprehensive staff development, instructional materials, programs to reduce truancy, and I'm shortening all of these, bilingual programs, all-day K, extended day, and substantial parent involvement.
Madam Chair, if I may.
Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you for your indulgence. It's just that this dialogue, I think, is so important because this is really what we
That's
need
why
to.
We're here.
Thank you. I hope that, you know, that I want to articulate this. Well, Senator, absolutely, I am okay with that part of it, of looking into the formula, and absolutely, Senator, that's exactly what we've been talking about, because I'm very frustrated with how this works and how we don't even understand how it works. But the connection with reading today is not that it is the wrong thing to do. I don't disagree. Of course, you know, we need to look at proficiency. That's what we measure. It's just that today, in this session, we're proposing that that is where we should attach it, right? And I'm afraid that when we make these kind of decisions where we say, well, it is reading. Well, I will ask, what about math? Math looks pretty bad, too. And what about, you know, science? I mean, if we need to be competitive. So the question here, really, I'm not questioning the motive of trying to figure out how is that we're using the dollars. Absolutely, I'm not. In fact, I appreciate that you're asking that question, because we need to. How do we ask that question, I think, is. And so, for instance, I would like to see, if we are to move these dollars right now, I would like to see a table where each district actually sees where this funding, how the equation changes for each district, right? And so each district, all of you, should see how this funding now is going to go into reading and have that conversation with your superintendents and say, is that okay? I mean, it's a chunk of money, and it's going to go to reading, and it's going to change all of that. Is that a good thing? I don't know the answer to that, Senator, but I think that is that's a good policy discussion, right? And then look at the connection with other formulas. So all I'm saying, Senator, is that we really need to have a more meaningful discussion about this policy, that we cannot just say, oh, I have an idea about this funding. There is a chunk of money here. I'm going to take it. That's just not good, because in 2 years I'm going to come and say that, and that's just not going to be good for some of your districts, okay? So that's not good. We've been doing that for many, many years, and we should stop.
Mr. Heller, you have been asked to say a few words about this bill. Would you like to come and address it? If you could do so rather quickly, we're running out of time, but you can come to the table. Mary Gilbert, he's coming.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm Mary Gilbert. I'm the legislative liaison for the St. Paul Public Schools, and we totally agree that kids should be able to read by third grade. As Catherine Rich pointed out to you, only 59% of the students in her school right now have been with her for 3 years. 40% of them are new. I looked at the statistics about how many kids are new to our district each year, and for the last 3 years, we've had 4,000 new kids come to us each year. So that's 12,000 new kids in 3 years, and of that group, almost 2,000 of them every year are kids that don't speak English, and lately, in the last couple of the years, they're primarily refugees. So the issue, you know, the luxury of us just focusing on the K-3, we'd love to have a completely static cohort of kids, you know, that we got in our pre-kindergarten program, and we track them over time. And we do have some data about that. Our district, though, gets 4,000 new kids a year, half of which are primarily, you know, refugees with no academic English whatsoever. And that's the group that, in addition to our regular kids, you know, roughly 60% of them, we've got 40% new that we're trying to bring up to standards at the same time. And not once this session has anybody suggested that we should ignore the 4 through 12-year-olds either and not make sure that they're college and career ready. You know what I mean? So I mean, I wish we had the luxury of being able to focus on that and do all the other stuff. The question for us is, whenever you talk about redoing the formulas, is what do you want us to quit doing, and which group of kids do you want us to now stop doing interventions on? And I think it's just simply a matter of, you know, your expectations are very high, and they're very high for every one of our kids in every one of our grades across the entire state. And that's a good thing. The question is, how do we, you know, serve them?
Thank you, Ms. Gilbert. Mr. Heller.
Thank you for this opportunity, Chair and Senators, speak on this. It's a privilege to be here. I'm up here in support of this bill about reading. I have been trying to represent the underrepresented, which are the print disabled and the twice exceptional children, which are children with print disability and a gift. Work closely with Anoka Hedman, try to understand what they use for their compensatory program. They had a 2-year study with the University of Minnesota. I think it's called CARI. And they made progress in math, but not in reading in a significant way. I think it's important that when you look at compensatory funding and what comes out of that, again, as we all know, we're using scaling up models, which are about response intervention, or we have the other option, which is about the What Works Clearinghouse, a higher rigor of standard on scientifically evidence-based, also research-based, more control. We have that choice. We're making the choice mostly go upscaling models. We all know that. I do have one thing about this thing about cutoffs for sixth grade. I believe it's found on page 2.28, and it has a cutoff for sixth grade. I'm not sure how they come up with that figure, frankly, because we all know about the NAEP, which goes around nationally and checks if you score. They check 4th, 8th, and 12th grade. I know that you don't catch kids up after 5th or 6th grade. We're not really probably going to look at those for intervention, I guess, just use strategies. I guess if you don't want to open that up past sixth grade, then that's the way it is. They're going to have to learn strategies how to cope if they can't read, I guess. That's one of the things. I had asked the district about 3 years ago why one of their goals talked about every kid will read well by second grade or third grade. And then I used the statute, which said second grade, and they said, well, reading is so broad. So now I see that it seems like the message I heard tonight was every kid will read well by third grade, as you heard from the commissioner. What I find interesting about this whole piece is it's called the fourth or fifth grade slump. And what happens to vocabulary and how fast it expands after that. And I'm convinced beyond a doubt that if you're not looking at the higher grades, because I currently know a student that's still in 10th grade and reading at a fifth grade level when you look at trend data, many snapshots. Yet when you look at the math, the kid's right on grade level. And this is likely a kid that's called twice exceptional. What happens is these kids have a disability, they get masked by a gift. I'd ask you to reconsider how that fits into this as far as where you're going to disconnect these kids and let them go. We all know that it's great to be proficient at third grade, but do we really know that for sure? In fact, isn't that why NAEP checks 8th and 12th grade? Obviously, we're moving ahead. We can't go back and fix the damage that's been done. But I look forward that there's change going on up here. And I'd appreciate that one person would look into this. I heard from a lady that writes for Riverside Testing for the Stanford MA. She says, don't you know, Mr. Heller, that kids for an average IQ, which is 90 to 110, don't read past the fifth grade level. Frankly, if that's the case, that certainly aligns with we're cutting them loose at sixth grade because there's a discrepancy, or call it what you want. But I guess if you feel that anywhere between sixth and eighth grade is proficient, something to consider. I thank you for this opportunity. I do want to mention one thing. I do, when I talk to Parents United, Mary, on page 1113 under item 8, talks about assurance of mastery and revenue. I've looked at reports online at the Minnesota Department of Education. It's my understanding that hasn't been funded for 2 or 3 years. Frankly, you might as well strike it off if they're not using it. Frankly, I don't even know what it means. I can't, to the best of me, if somebody could explain what assurance of mastery, because I've always asked the district, what is mastery for every grade? They never could tell me.
Thank you, Mr. Heller. I think it's true that while we've been focusing on third grade, if the foundation isn't laid in third grade, it's going to be handicap them at sixth and eighth and grade and beyond. That's why the focus has been there. But it doesn't mean that reading and instruction in reading and developing the comprehension and the vocabulary as it relates to every subject that is being studied isn't important all the way along. But thank you so much for your testimony. Is there any further discussion? If not, we will lay this on the table, and we will continue this dialogue as we work toward the deadlines that we have. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
We will have a hearing tomorrow in 1:12 at this time. Thank you. I will not.